Welcome to this State of Opportunity special, Waiting for Change. I'm Cynthia Canty. Politicians proclaim it. People argue about it. We hear it so often. Our immigration system is broken.
We have to finally, once and for all, fix our immigration system.
The problem of border security, internal enforcement.
Our immigration system is broken, and everybody knows it.
The U.S. immigration system is a web of policies. It's complex and it's confusing. Policies that touch everyone from a migrant farm worker to an international PhD student. But it's not just the immigrants coming here affected. We all are. These policies touch how much we pay for produce or a meal out on the town, who our neighbors are, and whether Michigan's small businesses can find enough talent to grow. For years now, lawmakers from both sides of the aisle have called for an overhaul of our immigration system. But nobody can agree on just what those changes should look like, especially when it comes to the 11 million undocumented immigrants living right now in this country. Think about that. That's about one in every 30 people. If you don't have papers, the outcome of this sharp political debate has deeply personal consequences. Susan Reed sees this play out every single day in the lives of undocumented immigrants and their families. She's the managing attorney at the Michigan Immigrant Rights Center in Kalamazoo. Susan Reed, welcome.
Thank you so much.
When you hear someone say, our immigration system is broken, what does that mean to you?
It means so many things in the lives of the clients that we see every day around the state. But the sharpest focus for me is always parents of U.S. citizen children, families who are here, who have no way to move forward with legal status. So many assumptions that people have. For example, if you marry a U.S. citizen or have a U.S. citizen child, there will be a path for you to legalize your status. And that's just not the case in our current system.
What discretion does Immigration and Customs Enforcement, does the federal government have in deciding whom to single out for deportation?
In terms of an individual family, there's a significant amount of discretion in terms of who is ultimately removed by Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Immigration judges do not have a lot of discretion. And in fact, the whole arc of the immigration law, particularly since 1996, very harsh measures enacted, signed into law by President Clinton in 1996, were really designed to strip immigration judges of their discretion.
And then you see the effect of what happens when a deportation order is handed down to a parent who has a child with U.S. citizenship or permanent residency.
You know, the parents of U.S. citizen children are deported every day. You know, I feel like that's another sort of myth we encounter that, well, you won't actually be deported if you've been a good person and you have a child. That's just not the law and not the practice. That is the kind of relief that the president was attempting in his 2014 executive actions to provide. We see families struggling every day with decisions about whether to take children with them to an uncertain or violent home country situation, whether to leave children, you know, in the care of friends or relatives, or even in the care of the state. So those are real decisions that Michigan families are facing every day.
And as you referenced, Susan, President Obama has stepped in with executive orders in 2012, the order that would allow some undocumented immigrants who were brought to this country as children to avoid deportation, the DACA or Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. And then there was that executive order in 2014, DAPA, Deferred Action for Parents of Americans and Lawful Permanent Residents. What did those change? And of course, as you say, this past June, that split decision by the U.S. Supreme Court essentially blocked DAPA from moving forward. But what did they change, especially DACA, for undocumented immigrants in Michigan?
DACA is the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, such an example of how ready, willing, and able non-citizens who don't have immigration status are to fully integrate and fully participate in our communities. About 7,000 young people in Michigan came forward starting in June 2012 to apply for the DACA program, and so many of those folks are really moving forward with their lives, which were on hold after they graduated from high school without immigration status, without the legal right to work, without access to scholarships and financial aid, which, by the way, continues to be true. Young people with DACA are still excluded from the whole financial aid system. They're totally excluded from the Affordable Care Act. We do see those young people struggling, but We see all around the state tremendous stories of leadership, of scholarship, of engagement with employers. Those young people with DACA have really had the chance to access driver's licenses, to have the legal right to work, to really participate fully. The DAPA program, we think, would have done the same thing. My daughter attends El Sol, which is a bilingual elementary school here in Kalamazoo, and many parents find themselves just longing to be more integrated, to be more involved, engaged in their community, but live with a lot of fear and anxiety. When school had career day, kids and parents had to be really reassured that the police and firefighters who were there to share their careers weren't there to break up families. I spoke personally with children who had those anxieties seeing law enforcement.
And with DAPA blocked by that Supreme Court decision, what do you see happening now?
That was a very devastating blow to those of us who saw a light at the end of this long tunnel of families struggling with this system. The folks who are community leaders are going to continue to advocate, are going to continue to bring forward stories and tell stories. There's so many community leaders who've really come forward to say, you know, we're undocumented and we're unafraid. We really need to come out as undocumented despite the risks. People need to know us. People need to not let a caricature of who we are be the image, be the dominant theme. And I've been just stunned by the courage of a lot of young people, young parents who are telling their stories. But I think it's easier for folks who don't have children. That's a tremendous risk to take for people who have children. We're still hopeful. We still believe in the goodness of this country and what it has to offer. And we're going to keep working for justice for families.
You know, there are a lot of Americans who say, in essence, look, I don't think we should ban immigrants from coming here, but we have a system. We have a law for people to follow. My grandfather followed the law. My husband did, coming as immigrants, following the rules. And if people come here without legal status, then they're essentially cutting the line. How do you answer that argument, Susan?
For so many people, there is no line to get in. And we had an economic policy through the 90s that essentially sort of left the back door to the country open while people flowed in response to supply and demand in the economy. And there was not a legal way to come. There was not a line to get in. There is not an opportunity for a farm worker in Michoacan whose cousin harvests asparagus in Michigan to apply for some kind of visa to come and do that. We could go into some detail about the H-2A guest worker program, but generally, most of the folks who came here were really coming to respond to an economic reality and also escape a negative economic reality. But they weren't cutting in a line. There wasn't a line to get in. And certainly many immigrants have, in the family-based immigration system, chosen or been able to wait for decades for visas to be available. And I can understand a feeling that, well, someone who didn't wait, you know, shouldn't benefit in any way. That's an incredibly harsh approach to take, given the real dynamic that has pushed people from certain countries and pulled them to ours, and the real contributions. People have subsidized whole industries with low-wage work. Many Americans have reaped many benefits from the economic participation of undocumented immigrants. And just to take an approach that believes that in some past time when really, if you showed up at the front door of the country, you entered in. I mean, when I hear that my grandfather came legally, I think people who say that know very little about what the process looked like when their grandfather came, and even less about what the process looks like today.
Susan Reed with the Michigan Immigrant Rights Center in Kalamazoo. Susan, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Cindy.
Javier Solorzano was 13 when his mother was sent back to Mexico. Shortly after that, his two brothers were also deported. Javier was left without any family in the U.S., so he moved in with his best friend until he graduated high school in Monroe and then went off to college. We asked Javier to reflect on the challenges of being separated from his family and how that has shaped the person he is today.
When I was younger, I knew there was something different about us, and I knew there was always a conversation about having papers, right? It's having papeles or tienes papeles, which means, you know, are you documented, right? I actually lived in apartments where most of the Latino people in Monroe live, and the Border Patrol would wait outside the apartments at 6, 7 in the morning, or even at night when they're coming home to basically take them there before they go to work or after they get back from work. When my mother, my ex-stepdad, and me applied to become permanent residents, everything was flowing well up until the interview date. When my mom crossed the border undocumented, she stayed in the U.S. for a certain amount of years. That enforced her to kind of have to be pardoned to be eligible to become a resident. The pardon could be either from a month or either 3 months to 10 years. My mom said, I want you to think about this, and I want you to tell me what you want to do. You know, at 13 years old, I didn't really have much, but she kind of put the options in front of me. She said, this is what you will get in Mexico, this is what you'll get in the U.S., and, you know, she somehow made me realize the importance of education and why I should continue my education here in the U.S. I spoke with my mom about once or twice a week on the phone. I would sometimes tell her, like, Mom, I don't know if this is worth it. I just want to leave. I want to be with my family. I just want to be normal. Like, why did these things happen to me? Why do I have to go through all of these things? Why me? You know, and she says, I have no idea. I can't answer that. But I can tell you that all of these things that you're going through are making you a stronger person. God told me she's going to be here and she's going to see you graduate. And I just knew God was going to be there. Like, He's the one who made this happen. For the first time in over 10 years, I was able to wake up and say, Mom, what do you want to do today? And for you to say, Mom, what do you want to do today? It sounds so easy, right? But I couldn't do that for the past 10 years. I've always had to say, what am I going to do today by myself?
Javier Solorzano graduated from the University of Michigan this past spring. He'll start his master's in higher education at U of M in the fall. Coming up next, think you don't encounter undocumented workers? Think again.
You can't really go a single day without encountering one of them, although you wouldn't know it because they're living under the radar.
You're listening to Waiting for Change, a State of Opportunity special from Michigan Radio.